In the small Northamptonshire village of Hardingstone, there's a wooden cross in the local church, and inscribed on that wooden cross are the words, "In memory of an unknown man, died November the 6th, 1930. And this is a man that we'll probably never know who he was, and all we know that he was found dead in a burnt-out Morris Minor, belonging to a veteran, a soldier of the First World War. But how did he come to be there? And what happened to that man who owned the car? What's the mystery behind this very sad story? Just a couple of miles away, but 18 years before, there lived a young lady called Miss Florence Louisa Swan. She lived in a place called Clouksham Street, a street that has a very rich World War I heritage. But this incident that I'm talking about took place 2 years before the war began, and poor Florence is lying in a bed in Northampton General Hospital as a result of being shot in the face with a revolver at her father's house. And the man who fired that bullet was another veteran, another soldier, her sweetheart, her boyfriend, Frederick James Cherry. Why did he do it? What happened to her? And what became of him when he went off to the Somme battlefields? So welcome to another edition of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And this week I thought we'd do something slightly different. The two stories that I've started telling are stories that involve soldiers from Northampton that served and in one case died on the Western Front in the First World War. And really what I wanted to do this week was to explain that whilst when we go to the Western Front, when we go to the beautiful silent cities, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, we look at the countless headstones and we think that all these men are heroes. We think that they all went to their grave having brought honour to their family and their country and themselves. But of course, life isn't like that. Society's not like that. Human beings are not like that. And I wanted to demonstrate that in this podcast this week. These are two of the stories, two serious stories that we're going to feature in a minute. But we've also got some perhaps more amusing stories about a man from Northampton called Digger Pugh, who went off to Australia and somehow turned himself into a celebrity as a result of what he said he'd done on the Western Front while serving with the Australian Army. We got a man who claimed that he'd been awarded the Victoria Cross and he came from Wellingborough in Northamptonshire. And then, perhaps in a more sinister way, a man called Daniel Kayes. Him and several of his mates betrayed his comrades. They went across no man's land and they gave themselves up to the German army. Perhaps not unusual, but what happened next was unusual. What happened next was absolutely awful and could well have jeopardised so many of their former comrades in the British Army. So here we go then. Let's start off with our first man, Alfred Arthur Rouse. And he was born on the 6th of April 1894, and his parents lived in Herne Hill in London. His mother was Irish, and apparently she was an actress. And in 1900, when he was just six, his parents' marriage broke up, apparently because his mother had deserted. And the family was split up, with Alfred and the other two children of the marriage were taken to be brought up by an aunt on his father's side. He went to a council school, but he was said to be quite bright and also athletic. When he left school, he learned carpentry and also went to evening classes where he learned to sing and to play musical instruments, including the piano, the mandolin and the violin. And it's said that he had quite considerable musical ability. He then worked as an office boy for an estate agent. And then in 1909, he used his carpentry experience to join a West End furniture manufacturer. And then, almost as soon as war broke out in August 1914, Rouse enlisted. He volunteered. And he was assigned to the 24th Queen's Regiment, the Londons. He was a private and he was given the regimental number of 2011. Carried out his basic training in England before the battalion left for France, arriving in March of 1915. Unlike so many of these men that went off to war, just before he went off to the Western Front, he married his fiancée, Lily May Watkins. And it wasn't long before Lily became pregnant, and not long after Rouse went off to the Western Front, he became a father. Now, his unit was committed to the Battle of Festubert, which took place in May of 1915, and Rouse later said that he came face to face with a German soldier, and he lunged at his enemy with his bayonet, but missed. and this affected his mind. The memory of just waiting for an instant for the enemy reply stayed with him, although that reply didn't come. He didn't say how that fight ended. But 11 days later, during the same battle, a high explosive shell exploded close to his head and it severely injured him, and he also had injuries to his thigh. Now, the army then used their evacuation process to get him out of the frontline trenches. He had an operation on his head to remove the shrapnel, but his leg injuries left him unable to bend his knee, and he could walk, but only with difficulty. He went back to the UK, and at a medical hearing on the 9th of December 1915, an army doctor said that his capacity to walk had been reduced by 75%. And then on the 11th of February 1916, Alfred was formally discharged from the army with a pension. And his medical records show at this stage he was still severely disabled. In July of 1916, the doctor noted that his memory was defective and he couldn't even wear a hat of any kind because the scar on his head from the operation was irritable. And they actually increased his pension to 25 shillings per week. At the end of January 1917, another doctor found progress in his condition. He believed that the injury to his leg could, and I quote, by degrees be overcome by the man's own endeavour. A year later, Rouse reported some dizziness, but the doctor noted that he was talkative, and he said that he laughs immoderately at times. And then in September 1918, Rouse complained of defective memory and bad sleeping. Now, by this time, the war had ended, but the medical hearings still go on. And in July 1919, Rouse was examined again by an unsympathetic doctor, and he observed that he was now suffered no disability from the head wound, and as a result, his pension was cut to just 12 shillings per week. And then finally, in August 1920, there was another examination that found that his head injury had completely healed, and his knee injury only now slightly affected his movement, and his pension was completely stopped in September of 1920 with a final lump sum of £41.05. So that's not an untypical story. A man that was on the Western Front just for a couple of months, he only took part in one battle. He was badly wounded, returned to England, and then he went through the painful process of rehabilitation, trying to find work, and all the medical boards, and no doubt there would have been financial struggles as well. But there, things change. His character changes. And it was to have awfully tragic results. When he left the army, he got a job as a commercial traveller, and his job took him all over a large area. By this time, he'd become estranged from his wife and his child, and he'd become a bit of a charmer, and he charmed his way into the lives and beds of dozens of women. And it's said that by 1930, he'd had over 80 women that he was going to see in various parts of the country, and he'd fathered several illegitimate children, and he'd even got married again, so he was a bigamist. One of his girlfriends was in hospital expecting a second child by Rouse, and Rouse, it was discovered, had got a pile of maintenance orders building up against him, and he knew there was no way that he could keep up these payments on his wages that he was earning as a travelling salesman. So Rouse decided the only way out of this situation was to vanish, and what better way to do that than to die in a fire? But then it all went wrong. At 2 o'clock in the morning of the 6th of November 1930, two young men called Brown and Bailey were walking home from their Guy Fawkes party near Hardingstone, and they noticed a well-dressed man carrying a briefcase that climbed out of a ditch in front of them. He walked past them without a word and turned to walk from Hardingstone Lane into the Northampton Road. Bailey then noticed a glow some 400 yards away and wondered what it was. The man with the briefcase said, "It looks as if someone's had a bonfire down there." Later on, both Brown and Bailey positively identified Rouse as the man with the briefcase. And at the subsequent trial, Brown said, "When you go home at that time in the morning, you do not usually see well-dressed men getting out of a ditch." Brown and Bailey then ran towards the bonfire. Rouse made his way to the main road and ultimately hitched a lift to London. And when Brown and Bailey got to the fire, they found it was a Morris Minor, which was blazing fiercely. The number plate was clearly visible, MU1468, and it was Rouse's car. They called the police. When the fire had been put out, they found a charred body was found in the front seat of the car. The police then found an empty jerry can, and on closer examination, it was discovered that the petrol cap was on, but loose. The top of the carburettor was missing, and that a junction in the petrol line was loose. The junction was in a position that petrol in the fuel line would drip into the front well of the car. where they found the body. Meanwhile, Rouse had hitched a lift to London. He told the driver he'd been waiting for a colleague to pick him up in his Bentley. He didn't mention that his own car had just burst into flames. He then caught a coach to Wales, and during that trip, he told the coach driver that his car had been stolen. Later that day, he went to see Ivy Jenkins, who were living there with her family. And of course, Rouse had been having an affair with Ivy. He told Ivy's father that his car had been stolen the day before. And then one of the neighbours or friends saw there was a photograph in the paper of a car which had been burnt the previous day. And seeing the photograph, in which the number plate was very clear, Rouse claimed that it wasn't his car. Ivy's sister had seen a photograph of the car. She showed him the article, in which he was named as the owner. He asked if he could take the article with him. He put it in his pocket and left the house. He went back to Hammersmith in London by coach. And when he got back to Hammersmith, there was a detective sergeant, Skelly, who met him. And apparently Rouse said to him, "Very well, I'm glad it's all over. I was going to Scotland Yard about it. I am responsible." So, of course, he's now charged with murder. But who was the man that was dead? He had no identification on him. And even to this day, nobody knows who that poor man was. The trial began on the 26th of January 1931, and to be honest, it didn't take very long. The Crown couldn't suggest a motive for the alleged murder, neither could they identify the body, so nothing could be suggested about the decease, which might explain an otherwise senseless killing. Now, during the trial, the evidence showed that Rouse had confessed to the police that he simply wanted to start life afresh and had taken out a £1,000 life insurance policy to ensure his wife and their six-year-old child were comfortable following his death, a death which, of course, didn't actually happen. So he intended to murder someone else and fake his own death to avoid the debts owed to the many women who had bore his children. And he went down to London and he went into a pub and he came across an acquaintance and someone that he knew a little bit. And this man apparently said to Rouse, "Governor, I've got nobody in the world who cares whether I live or die." Little did he know that that would cause him to die. This man had a similar build to Rouse. By his own admission, he'd said he wouldn't be missed and was therefore a perfect victim for Rouse's twisted plan. Rouse then told his victim he'd get him a job as a travelling salesman and he could work with him in the Leicester area. And the man agreed to travel to Leicester on November the 5th, bonfire night. But they never made it to Leicester. Instead, Rouse got the man drunk and pulling up in Hardingstone after dark, he strangled him, as he later confessed. Once he'd murdered the man, he then set the car alight. And of course, he picked the date intentionally, November the 5th. Lots of bonfires around that night. But why on earth, to be honest, he then carried out the murder in the main road? I really don't know. He hoped the fire had gone unnoticed. But as we now know, those two men were walking down the road. They saw not only the fire, but they were able to identify Rouse himself. Now, Rouse, although he said he was responsible, he claimed that the fire was a complete accident and he said that his drunken passenger had caused it by lighting a cigar in the car. But the trial heard that the dead man's clothing had been actually soaked in petrol. And of course, that's what Rouse had done. The jury was shown that the petrol tank had been loosened. And Rouse, of course, couldn't explain why he told his mistress that the car had been stolen. And when he arrived on her doorstep, he was apparently reeking of petrol. Now, the trial lasted 6 days. The jury were dismissed. They considered the evidence for just 25 minutes before arriving at their guilty verdict. Rouse still continued his innocence and he put in an appeal which was quickly dismissed. And it wasn't until shortly before his death that he finally admitted to a newspaper that he carried out the murder intentionally. On Tuesday, March the 10th, 1931, Alfred Rouse was hanged in Bedford Jail. Since then, 9 families have come forward to say that they had got relatives that disappeared in 1930, and DNA has been taken from all of them, but none of them have proved to be a match for the victim of this blazing car murder. And it's now over 90 years on. Inquiries are still ongoing into the victim of Alfred Rouse's infamous attempt to fake his own death. But this was a soldier. This was a man who experienced dreadful times during the Battle of Festubert, who was badly wounded. It affected his brain. He seemed to have been a good chap before the war. You know, he was part of the church, he got a good job, he was academically intelligent, but maybe, just maybe, those experiences on the Western Front in 1915 condemned him to the gallows. And that unknown man to a grisly death. So during the introduction, I talked about a young lady called Florence Louisa Swan, and she was shot by her boyfriend, a sweetheart, as he was called in the local paper, Frederick James Cherry, who was in fact a serving soldier at the time and went on to serve on the Somme in the First World War. So before we find out what actually happened to him, let's use the local newspaper and research carried out by historian Paul Johnson to find out exactly what happened in 1912. It says the shooting took place about 11:30 in the passage of the house in Clouncombe Street, where the girl Florence, with her mother and father, her brother and sister, Miss Swan, had been out with Cherry during the afternoon, and they returned to Clouncombe Street for tea. Later they went out again, accompanied by a friend. Another young man completed the four, and the party, on the most friendly terms, visited a singing room and spent a jolly evening. Swan and Cherry arrived back at Clouncombe Street about 11:15, and Lily, who was Florence's sister, went to bed immediately, leaving Florence and Cherry in the passage. They were the only people downstairs. And Mrs. Swan, who was not very well, had retired to rest early, and her husband followed about 11 o'clock. And what happened next is known only to the two people, Cherry and the girl, who's now battling for life in one of the wards of the local hospital. It says that Cherry had closed the street door on entering with the girls and all was perfectly quiet in the house when suddenly, after 5 or 6 minutes, the report of a revolver rang out, followed immediately by two other shots and then a scream and the sound of someone falling. The people in the house, terribly alarmed, rushed downstairs. Neighbours poured into the passage and the rooms on the ground floor. A crowd rapidly gathered in the street and all was confusion. The place was in darkness and the few seconds that elapsed, but when the seriousness of the situation was revealed, willing hands quickly got to work, and while some of the neighbours directed their attentions to the chief actors, others went off to summon the police and doctors, and later a messenger was dispatched for an ambulance. It was clear that Miss Swan had been badly injured. She was unconscious and bleeding from a wound in the left cheek, close to the nose and a little below the eye. There was a nurse, Mrs. Boddington, an experienced nurse who lived immediately opposite. She took the girl in charge, pending the arrival of medical assistance. Placing her arms under her, Mrs. Boddington lifted the girl and took her into the living room, where she bathed the wound and did all that was possible. She was received at hospital by Dr. Percival and was put to bed. The bullet had apparently taken an upward course, and it was suggested that it had lodged at the back of the eye. The condition of the girl was such, however, that it was impossible to attempt to find the missile, and Sunday afternoon it was discovered that the bullet is lodged in the brain. Miss Swan is in exactly the same condition as when admitted to the hospital, and there is no hope of recovery. The bullet is embedded in the right side of her brain. The revolver must have been held very close to Miss Swan's face when the trigger was pulled, for the skin was scorched and blackened by gunpowder. Those on the scene immediately state that Miss Swan lay on her back in the passage, her head not far from the bottom of the stairs, her feet towards the street door. Cherry was on the door with his left arm around the girl and was embracing her. In his right hand, he held the revolver, and he didn't offer the least resistance when a young man took the weapon from him. Others seized him while Miss Swan was removed into the living room, and then he was hustled into the kitchen at the back of the home and detained until the officers of the law arrived and he was taken into custody. It was stated that when discovered on the floor with the girl, Cherry said, "We're happy now." He said to show no signs of remorse, and he treated the matter very calmly. It then turned out that only one of the three shots actually struck Miss Swan. One was found in a passage and given to the police, and one is buried beneath the flooring. And to be honest, I think it's still there. Now, the mother of Florence, she told a representative of the newspaper that her daughter had known Cherry since last Christmas, and he talked about being married at Christmas this year, and that Florence had been making clothing in preparation for the wedding. "She was a real good girl," said Mrs. Swan. Ironically here, she's talking about a girl in the past tense, but as we're going to discover in a minute, she didn't actually die. Cherry had been in the army in the Northamptonshire Regiment, and it was for a time he was in India. When he finished his service a few months ago, he got a job as an attendant in an asylum. But lately, he'd made up his mind to leave the asylum and go to Canada to be a policeman. Mrs. Swan said that he seemed quite as usual on Saturday. He went down the town shopping with her and came back. They went out again about 6:30, and I never saw them again, she said. He bought us some chocolates. They're in our pocket now. Now, at this stage, Cherry was 26 years old. He recently left the army after 7 years' service. And he'd proved to be a popular and a good soldier. And he was good at athletics and football. Although he'd been promoted to Lance Corporal, he made the decision himself to go back to the rank. A witness said that on Friday, he brought a small parcel home. And when he opened the parcel, it was a revolver. The witness said, "What are you going to do with that? We don't want it in this house with the children about." And he said, "It's all right. I shall want it in the part of the country I'm going to." One of the witnesses at the trial said that the girl was picked up and put on a couch and someone bathed the wound. We got Cherry into the kitchen and then he was arrested and I was sent for a stretcher. The witness was asked whether anything was said by either man. He said, "Yes," he said. Cherry said, "I was jealous of the girl." Now, incredibly, Florence survived. She wasn't killed. It seems remarkable to me, and always has done since I've known about this story, that she could be shot in the head with a bullet lodged in her brain, and somehow that poor woman survived. A newspaper report in one of the local papers reported that a few days later there was no change in the condition of Florence. She does not recognise any of her friends, but has attempted to speak once or twice, but without success. I also read another report of her sister going to see her at the hospital when she squeezed her hand, but that's as much as she could do, communicate. So because Florence hadn't died, somehow she'd survived. Cherry avoided the charge and the sentence of murder, and of course at that time in history he would have been hanged. He pleaded guilty to a lesser charge of shooting with intent to do grievous bodily harm, and he was sentenced, incredibly, to just 3 years penal servitude. And this was because he'd been in the army and served in India. He went off to Maidstone Prison, where he served his sentence. And when he was released in 1915, he went back to the 1st Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. And off he went with his battalion to the Battle of the Somme, where on the 18th of July 1916, whilst he avoided the hangman's noose, he couldn't avoid the fire of the German army. And he died, killed in action. And now he lies beneath the Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone in the beautiful location of Contlemason Chateau Cemetery, in amongst other soldiers there. And of course, every soldier in death is treated equally. And of course, when you look at his grave, there is no mention of what he carried out, that horrendous act that he'd carried out some 4 years before in Northampton. And he's also remembered on the war memorial in Abingdon Square in Northampton. So what became of Florence? Well, she was born in 1882. She was one of 13 children, and 9 of them were still alive when she was shot. 7 of them, as well as her mum and dad, were living in this terraced house in Clowson Street. And I found her on the 1939 census, still living in Northampton, and with a man called George Taylor. But I don't know who George was. But she was an invalid. And it would appear that that bullet fired by her boyfriend was still in her brain. And what this is, 27 years later, she still hadn't recovered. And there's evidence that Paul Johnson has discovered that she lived until 1964, 52 years after she'd been shot. And she was an invalid for the rest of her life. An awful, tragic story that effectively ended one person's life. But eventually, Frederick was to pay the penalty, not for his crime, but one of the victims of the Great War. Now, as I said, this awful shooting took place in a street called Clowson Street, not far from the town centre in Northampton. And it's an unremarkable street that was built in the Victorian 19th century, and it housed the many employees of the various boot and shoe factories around Northampton. And on each of these streets, you can imagine the scene, as these streets are in most Victorian parts of towns. Row upon row of terraced houses, usually 2 bedrooms, and in those days they'd have had an outside toilet. And when you stand at the end of Clowson Street now, you can imagine a shop on one corner and a pub on another. And this unremarkable street gave up 100 men, over 100 men, who went off to the Great War in one form or another. And researchers discovered that over 20 of these men didn't come home. And we're going to touch on another story from Clowson Street later in the podcast. But let's just have a quick look at some of those men that went off to the war. There was a William Chandler. He joined the 6th Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment, and he went missing after being wounded on an attack on Trones Wood on the 14th of July 1916. Like so many of these men, he worked in the shoe industry at Crockett and Jones, a factory that gave up 2 of its sons to the Great War. He'd volunteered in August of 1914, and his family, clearly distressed for having no news about him, put an advert in the local paper and said the parents would be very grateful for any news of him. Sadly, his body was never found. They didn't have any closure, and he's now remembered on the Teatvale Memorial to the Missing. Then there was Private L. Richards. He worked for another shoe factory, G.T. Hawkins. He was wounded in the head by shrapnel, but he did come home. Ralph McNess was wounded 3 times. Gunshot wound in the right arm. He was shot in the heel and shrapnel wounds. His brother Frank served with the 1st Canadians and was wounded at Eat. James Aldous, he'd served in the Northamptonshire Regiment for 12 years before the war. He was killed holding the line on the Menin Road during the First Battle of Ypres in November 1914. And Frederick Richardson, aged just 19, died of wounds and buried in Lichtenhoek Military Cemetery in Belgium. There was a John Healy. He was engaged to Miss Page, and he was killed capturing that German mine crater that's still there in High Wood in September of 1916, another with no known grave and remembered at Teatvale. Samuel Jackson, 2 brothers also serving, they came home. He was killed on the Somme in 1916. He was one of 4 men killed that day during mine warfare at Fricourt. And the inscription on his headstone says, "He answered his country's call, Dad, Mother, Sisters and Brothers." Number 54, Clouncham Street, lived 3 brothers, Richard, Edward and William. Richard was killed in November 1917 as the North Ants moved up to the line. He was one of 3 men that went missing that day, and they probably drowned in the mud. His 2 brothers, Edward and William, also died in the war. They didn't come home. At number 59, George Twistleton. He was with the Duke of Cornwall Light Infantry, went missing during the First Battle of Ypres in October 1914, when his trench was overrun by the Germans. He left a wife and 2 children. These are just a few of the stories from Clouncham Street. As I said, it's an unremarkable street. There's lots of streets like this in the town where you live, and it's worth going out and investigating them, usually through the local papers. If you look in the local papers, you'll get lots of information about what happened to these men from your town. But whenever we walk around Northampton on a tour, a World War One heritage tour that we do, we walk down Clouncham Street, we look at these houses, and we tell the story of those men that didn't come back and some that did. And of course, we tell the story, the terrible story of what happened to Florence. So now let's go beyond Northampton and look at the story of Private 40429 Daniel Keyes from the 1st Battalion of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers. He joined up with the Ulster section of the Army Service Corps in January of 1915. He was 20 years old and working as a labourer. But on his service records, it tells us that he was declared a deserter. And the entry is dated February 1915, when he's still on basic training. It doesn't say what his penalty was, but he must have been reprieved because he rejoined and he went overseas on the 9th of September 1915. But he was back home in February 1917 when he got married in Lisbon. And then the next documents I found in his service record confirm that he became a prisoner of war on the 18th of December 1917. And the record says that this happened at Cambrai. And this was not long after the famous tank battle, when, of course, the Germans had carried out a major counter-offensive and captured many prisoners of war. He was then taken to a camp called Dolmen, which is near Munster in Germany, between Munster and Dortmund. When we look at the early stages of the Battle of Cambrai, we can see that Daniel and his battalion was one of those units that made splendid progress, it says in a battalion diary, and achieved all of their objectives. And they captured hundreds of terrified German defenders, no doubt stupefied by seeing these hundreds of tanks heading towards them. On the 26th of November, the battalion was withdrawn from the line and went into reserve. And it said that they had baths and received fresh clothing. And that meant that they avoided the start of the massive German counter-offensive on the 30th of November. On the 2nd of December, they were back in the trenches and lost 5 men captured by the Germans during a night raid that was carried out in silence. On the 4th, they moved to the southern end of the battlefield and they'd marched 12 miles in 3 hours. And then on the 17th, the battalion diary says that having had a few days' rest, They're in frontline trenches again. The diary shows that the ground was snow-covered, frosty and very cold. The diary entry for the next day reveals a quiet day with no German attack and no casualties. So how did he become a prisoner of war on that day? Well, to find out the answer, I'm very grateful to the research that was carried out by a man called Peter Barton. And he discovered that on that night, the 18th December 1917, four privates of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers left their machine gun post east of the Somme. They crossed no man's land and they deserted to the enemy. And one of those men was our man. The Germans were given a long list of grievances. The trenches the Irish lived in were poorly dug. They said the food was deteriorating and they were living on biscuits and cold tea. Leave had been denied and they were continually under strength. But the real reason, it says, that they deserted was because of the political situation at home in Ireland in the aftermath of the Easter Rising. What made things worse was that the four men signed off with an extraordinary message, which Peter Barton believes was printed and airdropped as a leaflet over the British lines. And I've got a copy of that document in front of me. And it says, "Dear chums," and don't forget this is a letter to his comrades, or to their comrades, "you are all a lot of fools to be staying there in those goddamn dirty trenches. There is no such thing as shawling you. The Germans are the nicest people I've ever met. We are getting plenty of bread and no such thing as bully beef. For your dinner, too. Blankets and a fine straw bed to lie in. And if I could only get back to tell you the life we have here, it's better than Blighty. Take my advice and come over and not be fighting for England any longer." And then it's signed by those four men. The truth, of course, was somewhat different. By this time in the war, the Germans were beginning to struggle to feed themselves and the people at home. And the reality was that some British prisoners of war were being treated and made to work long hours in poor conditions with poor food and accommodation. There's no record what happened to these men at the end of the war, no record of them being court-martialed when they were released from captivity. But I can't find any records of any medals being awarded to Daniel, and it's possible that they weren't awarded to him because of that treacherous act in that cold winter of 1917. The reason I've included the story of Daniel in this podcast is another reminder that not all soldiers were heroes, and he and his mates certainly were not. We now turn to a man from Wellingborough in Northamptonshire, who before the war in a remote way had been connected with the Salvation Army. And in their journal that they call War Cry, he'd claimed to have been awarded the Victoria Cross. But in May 1918, the local newspaper discovered that he was in fact a bogus. The article says, "The news of a Wellingborough man, bandsman William Isaac Kennell, having won the Victoria Cross, which appeared in War Cry last week, it is now appears to be untrue. From facts that have come to light, it appears that Kennell made up the whole story of how he won the honour and how he was decorated by the King at Buckingham Palace. He was interviewed by a press correspondent at Chatham, to whom he told what appeared to be a straightforward story. He was then wearing the VC ribbon. Later inquiries led to the discovery that the whole story had no more basis than that of this man's imagination." After the war, we see a troubled character and a man that got in trouble many times with the police. In April 1922, Kennell was then working as a labourer and he was charged with indecently assaulting a Miss Elizabeth Bigley at Findon on January the 3rd. The prisoner pleaded guilty. Superintendent MacLeod gave the prisoner a very bad character. Whenever the prisoner was at liberty, the police were bombarded with complaints of young women and girls being insulted and interfered with. He had been several times convicted of offences against females and he was sentenced to 6 months in prison. But he obviously didn't learn because 2 years later he was back in court on another conviction, and this time it says he was a Corrigal rogue and also charged with indecency. January the 25th, the prosecution counsel said, once again, it was Superintendent MacLeod, and he gave the history of the prisoner after his first conviction for stealing in 1922, and he'd had several times been convicted since. It says his army career was assessed as being bad, and a sentence of 12 months was passed on this occasion. So for our final story this week, we go back to Cloutsham Street in Northampton. And this time we look at someone who would these days be described as a lovable rogue, a man called Wallace Pugh, who was known fondly as Digger. And the first thing we do is look at a newspaper report dated 1916, which I'll read to you. And it said, a Northampton's lad's amazing adventure in South Africa, France and Australia were contained in a letter which Mr and Mrs Pugh of No. 12 Cloutsham Street received on Tuesday morning. Their son, who'd reached his 15th birthday on August the 11th last, had been missing since the middle of April 1916, and this was the first news they'd received that he was alive. Young Pugh, Bombardier Wallace Pugh, was serving with the Australian Light Trench Mortar Battery. He was always of a roving disposition. He soon tired of his work in a London hotel and went to Brighton. He was brought back to Northampton by his father, but almost immediately disappeared again. He was traced to London, but nothing further could be learned of him. From the letter received on Tuesday, which was dated July 1917 and was written from a wounded soldier's restroom in Melbourne, Australia, it appears that he stowed himself away on a boat bound from London to Durban in South Africa. Hearing that the bugler of the Australian battalion was ill, he offered his services and was accepted, not as a bugler, but as a mascot. In this capacity, he was taken to France. He says he never received any pay as a soldier, and the only money he received had been given to him by the colonel. He was, in fact, an unofficial soldier, and his name was not on the battalion records. With the Australians, he took part in the Battle of the Somme, where he was wounded with a bullet, and in the Battle of Bapaume received a shrapnel wound and was gassed. He was water carrier, messenger, ammunition carrier, and, to use his own words, a general nuisance to everybody. He was unable to throw bombs properly, but managed to take the pins and lob them into the Germans' dugouts during the clearing up operations. After being wounded, he was sent to a London hospital, and from there he was, on account of his youth, taken by the officer to Australia. In Melbourne, he was lionised and is now making recruiting speeches. He sent home a photograph of himself speaking on a town hall steps at Melbourne. In his letter, he states that he's now receiving £4 a week as a recruiting speaker. And then there's this incredible photograph of him looking so young, a boy of 15. And the photograph is headed with the words, stowaway. And it also goes on to say that he said he'd been gassed in France, but he's now back home. But I've done some research into his story. The unit that he was serving with was in fact involved in July 1916 in the Battle of Fromelles, and two men from his unit were killed on the 20th of July 1916, and his division, the 5th Division, lost 5,500 casualties during that awful battle. In 1934, he went on to form a dance group called the Wallabies, which included his then wife, his daughter and his niece. In 1937, he did come close to death when he somehow found himself with the Wallabies in Shanghai when it was bombed by the Japanese. And in 1939, he married again, this time marrying a lady called Sheila in Lambeth. In 1941, his brother Stanley was killed during the Second World War. And in 1951, he sailed from New York into Southampton on the QE2. But as he arrived into the UK, his luck finally ran out when he was arrested for submitting a false passport application. Digger Pugh died in 1969, having been married twice, and he had four children during his colourful life. Going back to 1937, a local newspaper in Northampton printed an account of what happened when Pugh witnessed the bombing of Shanghai. It says, looking bronzed and energetic, Mr. Wallace Pugh talked to the Mercury and Herald reporter about Shanghai after its first bombing. A week before, Mr. Pugh's troop of acrobatic tumblers, the Wallabies, were due to appear at the Great New World at a huge amphitheatre in Shanghai. It was bombed by the Japanese air raiders. Mr. Pugh told an appalling story of the scene 6 days after the bombing. The boat on which he and his troop travelled was delayed 4 days by bad weather. The boat struck a typhoon, and before it docked at Tilby, it crashed into an oil tanker. Mr. Pugh and the Wallabies are in England for a year before going to India on a contract. Mr. Pugh hopes to present his show for the first time in Northampton. This was quite a character, wasn't he? He'd somehow blagged his way into the Australian Army. That much is true. How much he was involved in the fighting, we'll never know, because there's no record of him whatsoever, no official record of him anyway. But then he's formed this troop involving his family after the war, and he's come close to death on a few occasions. Another article says that Mr. Pugh has been to every country in the world, including Russia and Germany, with the exception of the South American states and Iceland. Since the war began, the troop had been in Italy, Egypt — this is the Second World War — Italy, Egypt, India, Ceylon and Singapore, Australia and New Zealand. And then in 1953, there's another article in the paper that says Northampton-born Wallace Pugh from Hounslow, who was living in Hounslow at the time, was arrested aboard the liner Queen Elizabeth at Southampton and was remanded on £190 bail until July the 22nd. He was charged with making false statements on an application form for a passport for Mrs. Eileen Davis. Now, we know that there was an element in truth of what he talked about in the First World War in that newspaper article, because a researcher found an officer who'd served on the Somme and returned to Australia, and he did verify that he'd met Pugh on the Western Front. And this man was a Colonel McNab, and he was described as the officer that had taken Pugh under his wing. And there is evidence that Pugh did feature as an official key speaker at several recruiting drives in Melbourne. The National Archives of Australia does not hold a file on Pugh as a soldier, but there is a file on a man called John Willis Llewellyn Pugh as a munitions worker, number 531, and that's an indication of what Pugh did following his time as a recruiter. So there we go. There's a collection of stories ranging from murderers, attempted murderers, and men who imagined that they'd been awarded the Victoria Cross, when in fact they hadn't. And I think this shows us that, as with any organisation, the British Army was made up of all sorts of different people. We often talk about heroes and men that gave their lives for the sake of others. But of course, in amongst their ranks were charlatans, frauds, and men that you perhaps wouldn't want to be with in the trenches or in any other walk of life either. But that's history. You can't change history. You can't rewrite history. These men existed, and they all make up the story of the Great War. And that's what this podcast is all about, telling the stories that you perhaps wouldn't hear on a battlefield tour or read about these people in the books that are written about the Great War. So that's it for this week. Thanks again for tuning in to the podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. And by the time you read this, I'll be back on the battlefields of the Somme and Ypres, guiding a party of 7 people, following in the footsteps of their relatives on the Western Front. And in a few weeks' time, I'll be making the trip to the beautiful city of Cologne in Germany. And as part of that tour, I'll be visiting the Southern Cemetery in Cologne, where thousands of British soldiers from the First World War and the Second World War are buried. Many of these men died in captivity of their wounds, and so many of them died in the flu epidemic at the end of the First World War in 1918 and 1919. So I've got a number of stories that I'm going to take with me to that cemetery and record a podcast whilst I'm there. But if anybody has got any stories that they're aware of in their own family or through other sources, then please do get in contact with me through my website. My email is terry@terrystours.co.uk, because I would love to find out more information about some of the soldiers that are in that cemetery. And a cemetery that is well away from the Western Front. It was concentrated from many cemeteries that were all over Germany, and this cemetery, I think, was enlarged in the 1950s. So that will be coming up in a few weeks' time, that podcast. But as I say, if you've got any stories about any soldiers that you're aware of that are buried in that cemetery, then do get in touch. But that's it for this week, and as usual, I'd like to play The Last Post. But as you listen to The Last Post, there's one footnote to the story of Alfred Rouse, the man who carried out the murder in the burning car. If you remember, the car was a Morris Minor, and I've recorded this podcast over the last couple of days whilst in Norfolk, where I brought my mum for a few days' break. And this morning, after recording the podcast, we went down to the local village, Mundersley, for a cup of tea. And as we were sitting there, there was lots of people milling around. We were people watching, as you do. And then what drove past? There was a classic car rally in Cromer yesterday. And what drove past was a Morris Minor. the subject of the story of Alfred Rouse. Another coincidence, perhaps? I'll leave you to decide.